The Carnation Contented program, usually presented over most of these stations at this time, will not be heard this evening in order that we may bring you a special broadcast. The following period has been purchased by the Republican National Committee for the presentation of Governor Thomas E. Dewey, Republican nominee for the office of President of the United States. First, we turn the program over to his special announcer, Ford Bond.
This is the climax of Governor Dewey's tour that has brought him into close contact with the people of state after state. During this lengthy trip, he has learned of the problems firsthand of the people of our country. They have recognized his serious and direct approach to the solutions, so the years 1945 to 49 can be peaceful and prosperous for us all. In Oklahoma City, United States Senator Edward H. Moore is about to introduce Governor Dewey. So now to Oklahoma City, to its municipal auditorium, and Senator Moore.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished guests, fellow citizens of Oklahoma, I know we may take great pride here this evening in having the honor...
Senator Moore, Governor Sheppel, my friend, the next senator from Oklahoma, Bill Utchin, fellow Americans everywhere. For 2.5 weeks, I have been laying before our people the program I believe we must adopt if we're to win here at home the things for which our American men are fighting abroad. In 6 major speeches, I have set forth a part of that program. There is much more to come. In doing this, I have been deeply conscious that this campaign is being waged under the most difficult circumstances and at the most trying time in the history of our nation. Our national unity for war and for the cause of lasting peace must be strengthened as a result of this campaign. I believe the conduct of the campaign on our side has greatly strengthened that unity. I had assumed that every American joined me in hoping that would be the spirit of this campaign. Last July, Franklin Roosevelt, in accepting his party's nomination for a fourth term, said, and I quote, "I shall not campaign in the usual sense. In these days of tragic sorrow, I do not consider it fitting," he said. Last Saturday night, the man who wants to be president for 16 years made his first speech of this campaign. Gone was the high-sounding pledge. Forgotten were these days of tragic sorrow. It was a speech of mudslinging, ridicule, and wisecracks.
Hey!
It plumbed the depths of demagogy by dragging into this campaign the names of Hitler and Goebbels. It descended to quoting from Mein Kampf and to reckless charges of fraud and falsehood. Let me make one thing entirely clear. I shall not join my opponent in his descent to mudslinging. If he continues in his desire to do so, he will be all alone. I shall not use the tactics of our enemies by quoting from Mein Kampf. I will never divide America. Those tactics also I leave to my opponent. I shall never make a speech to one group of American people inciting them to hatred and distrust of any other group. In other nations, the final product of such discord has been communism or fascism. We must never reap that harvest in America. The winning of this war and the achievement of a people's peace are too sacred to be cast off with frivolous language. I believe that Americans whose loved ones are dying on the battlefronts of the world, men and women who are praying daily for the return of their boys, want the issues which vitally affect our future discussed with the utmost earnestness. This I shall continue to do with full consciousness of the solemn obligation placed upon me by my nomination for President of the United States. My opponent, however, has chosen to wage his campaign on the record of the past and has indulged in charges of fraud and falsehood. I am compelled, therefore, to divert this evening long enough to keep the record straight. He has made the charges. He has asked for it. Here it is. Describes as, and I quote him, "a fantastic charge," the statement that his administration plans to keep men in the army when the war is over, and that it intends to keep them there because it fears there will be no jobs for them in civil life. Well, who brought that up? Here's the statement of a high official of the administration as reported on August 23, 1944, in the publication of the United States Army, the Stars and Stripes. He said, "We can keep people in the Army about as cheaply as we could create an agency for them when they are out." Now, who said that? It was the National Director of Selective Service, appointed by Mr. Roosevelt and still in office. But, says Mr. Roosevelt, the War Department thereafter issued a plan for what he called speedy discharges. You can read that plan from now until doomsday, and you cannot find one word about speedy discharges. It is, in fact, a statement of the priority in which men will be discharged after the war. It does not say whether they are to be retained in service a month or years after victory. That will be up to the next administration. The present administration, with its record of peacetime failure, is afraid to bring men home after victory. That's why it's time for a change. Now, why does my opponent first describe what is a matter of record as a fantastic charge, and then try to laugh off the problem of jobs after the war? He jokes about depressions, about the 7 straight years of unemployment of his administration, but he cannot laugh away the record. In March of 1940, Mr. Roosevelt had been in office 7 years. Yet the Depression was still with us. We still had 10 million Americans unemployed. Those are not my figures. Those are the figures of the American Federation of Labor. Is that fraud or falsehood? If so, let Mr. Roosevelt tell it to the American Federation of Labor. By waging relentless warfare against our job-making machinery, my opponent succeeded in keeping a depression going 11 long years, twice as long as any previous depression in our history. And the somber, tragic thing is that today, he still has no better program to offer. That is why the New Deal is afraid of peace. That's why it resorts to wisecracks and vilification. When our people want victory, followed by lasting peace in the world and jobs and opportunity here at home, that's why it's time for a change. Now, I had not intended in this campaign to rake over my opponent's sad record of failing to prepare the defenses of this country for war. It's all in the past, a very tragic past. It has cost countless American lives. It has caused untold misery. But my opponent has now brought that subject up. He seized violently upon the statement that we're not prepared for war when it came. In his speech of Saturday night, he called that a falsification which not even Goebbels would have invented. Now, were we prepared for war or were we not? It's a perfectly simple question of fact. In 1940, the year after the war began in Europe, the United States was in such a tragic condition that it couldn't put into the field as a mobile force 75,000 men. The Army was only 25% ready. Now, Mr. Roosevelt, did those statements come from Goebbels? Was that fraud or falsification? Those are the words of General George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff of the United States Army, under oath. I quote again. December 7, 1941, found the Army Air Forces equipped with plans, but not with planes. Did that come from Goebbels? That statement was made in an official report on January 4th of this year by H.H. Arnold, Commanding General of the Army Air Forces of the United States of America. Does my opponent still desire to use the words falsification and Dr. Goebbels? Does he still claim? If so, let's go further. 4 months before Pearl Harbor, there was a debate in the United States Senate. The chairman of a Senate committee described on the floor of the Senate the shocking state of our defense program. Senator Vandenberg asked the chairman where the blame should be laid. And Dr. Stibbing? If so, let's go further. 4 months before Pearl Harbor, there was a debate in the United States Senate. The chairman of a Senate committee described on the floor of the Senate the shocking state of our defense program. Senator Vandenberg asked the chairman where the blame should be laid. And the chairman replied, "There's only one place where the responsibility can be put." Then Senator Vandenberg said, "Where is that? The White House?" And the chairman of that committee replied, "Yes, sir." Who was that committee chairman? It was Harry Truman, the New Deal candidate for Vice President of the United States. Again, in a magazine article in November 1942, this statement appeared. The reasons for the waste and confusion the committee found were everywhere the same. The lack of courageous, unified leadership and centralized direction at the top. Again, on the floor of the Senate in May 1943, these words were uttered. After Pearl Harbor, we found ourselves woefully unprepared for war. Was that Dr. Goebbels on the floor of the Senate? The very words my opponent calls a falsification came from the mouth of his running mate, Harry Truman, the Democratic nominee for vice president. Now listen to this. When the treachery of Pearl Harbor came, we were not ready. Mr. Roosevelt, was that from Dr. Goebbels? The man who said that was Alvin Barclay, your majority leader of the United States Senate. And where do you suppose Alvin Barclay said, when the treachery of Pearl Harbor came, we were not ready? Right in his speech nominating Mr. Roosevelt for a fourth term. Now, why is it we weren't ready when we were attacked? Let's look at my opponent's own words. In a message to Congress in 1935, he said, "There is no ground for apprehension that our relations with any nation will be otherwise than peaceful." In 1937, he said, and I quote, how happy we are that the circumstances of the moment permit us to put our money into bridges and boulevards rather than into huge standing armies and vast implements of war. But war came just 2 years later. It was in January of 1940 that I publicly called for a two-ocean navy for the defense of America. It was that statement of mine which Mr. Roosevelt called, and I quote his words, just plain dumb. Then, as now, we got ridicule instead of action. The war rose in fury when Hitler's armies were at the gates of Paris. Mr. Roosevelt once again soothed the American people with the jolly comment, there is no need for the country to be discomboomerated. The simple truth is, of course, that my opponent's record is desperately bad. The price the American people have had to pay for that record is desperately high. This is not a record on which any man should seek the confidence of the American people. My opponent now announces his desire to be president for 16 years. Yet, in his speech of Saturday night, he called it a malicious falsehood that he had ever represented himself to be indispensable. Let's look at these closely supervised words of his hand-picked candidate for vice president. Mr. Truman said of my opponent, and I'm quoting him, the very future of the peace and prosperity of the world depends upon his re-election in November. Now, I have not heard Mr. Truman repudiated by Mr. Roosevelt as yet. He usually waits to shed his vice presidents until they have served at least one term. The words of Boss Kelly of the Chicago Machine. He was the manager of that fake third-term draft of 1940, you remember? He said, the salvation of this nation rests in one man. Was that statement ever repudiated by my opponent? No, it was rewarded by increased White House favors. So it was repeated again by the same man at the same time in the same city and for the same purpose this year. The salvation of this nation rests in one man. Now, was it a malicious falsehood that one of the first acts of my opponent's newly selected national chairman was to announce last May that he was for a fourth term? And that he was looking forward toward a fifth term. Let's get this straight. The man who wants to be president for 16 years is indeed indispensable. He is indispensable to Harry Hopkins, to Madam Perkins, to Harold Ickes. He's indispensable to a host of other political job holders. He's indispensable to America's leading enemy of civil liberties, the mayor of Jersey City. He's indispensable to those infamous machines in Chicago, in the Bronx, and all the others. He's indispensable to Sidney Hillman and the Political Action Committee. He's indispensable to Earl Browder, the ex-convict and pardoned communist leader. Shall we, the American people, perpetuate one man in office for 16 years?
No!
Shall we do that to accommodate this motley crew? Shall we expose our country to a return of the 7 years of New Deal depression because my opponent is indispensable to the ill-assorted, power-hungry conglomeration of city bosses, communists, and career bureaucrats which now compose the New Deal. Shall we submit to the Council of Despair that in all the great expanse of our nation, there is only one man capable of occupying the White House? The American people will answer that question in November. They will see to it that we restore integrity to the White House so that its spoken word can be trusted once again. On battlefields and at home, Americans have won the admiration of the world. Under the stress of war, we have thrown off the stupor and despair that seemed in the decade of the 1930s to have settled permanently on our land. Today, we know our strength and we know our ability. Shall we return to the philosophy my opponent proclaimed when he said, "Our industrial plant is built"? Shall we go back to the 7 straight years of unemployment? Shall we go back to the corroding misery of leaf raking and doles? Shall we continue an administration which invokes the language of our enemies and recklessly hurls charges of falsehood concerning things it knows to be the truth? I say the time has come to put a stop to everything that is summed up in that phrase, the indispensable man. If any man is indispensable, then none of us are free. But America hasn't lost its passionate belief in freedom. America has not lost its passionate belief in opportunity. It need never lose those beliefs. For here in this country of ours, there is plenty of room for freedom and for opportunity. And we need not sacrifice security to have both freedom and opportunity. To achieve these objectives, we must have integrity in our government. We need a new high standard of honesty in the government of the United States. We need a singleness of purpose, a devotion to the people of this country and to the gigantic problems we face at home after this war. We need a whole-souled devotion to the building of a people's peace that will last far beyond the lives and friendships of any individuals. We need humility and courage. With the help of Almighty God, we shall achieve the spiritual and physical strength to preserve our freedom in the pursuit of happiness for all.
return you now to New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, as we go off the air, we want to call your attention to a coast-to-coast broadcast on behalf of the Dewey Bricker Ticket by Everett Dirksen, Congressman Everett Dirksen, on Wednesday night at 8:15 p.m. Eastern Wartime.
Time for the presentation of Governor Thomas E. Dewey, Republican nominee for the office of President of the United States, was purchased by the Republican National Committee. The Carnation Contented program, usually broadcast at 10 p.m. Eastern Wartime over most of these stations, will be heard at its regular time next Monday. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
KFI, Los Angeles.